Hold on to your people because you will need them on the bounce back on the other side. Wherever possible, support them. Full-time, part-time, casual, including with paid leave if they need to take time off during the course of the virus.
We're worried that these workers will have to choose between feeding themselves, paying the bills, or going to work. And other countries face the same problem, and what they've done is put in special measures to make sure these workers get sick leave during the dealing with this crisis.
That's Australian Council of Trade Union Secretary Sally McManus and Prime Minister Scott Morrison earlier this week. Unions are now calling on the government to legislate 2 weeks paid leave for all workers directly impacted by the coronavirus, whether they're permanent, casual or contract. And as the virus spreads, the very real worry for millions of Australian employees isn't toilet paper supplies, it's how they'll pay their bills if they have to go into quarantine. Professor Andrew Stewart is with us today from the Adelaide Law School, and Giri Savaraman is an employment lawyer with Maurice Blackburn. Giri, Andrew, welcome to Life Matters.
Thanks.
Thanks, Hilary.
Giri, what kinds of sick leave protections do we have in Australia at the moment?
Well, fundamentally, you have a paid personal leave or carer's leave for employees covered by the Fair Work Act, which is most employees across the country except for state government and in some areas local council, and that gives you paid personal leave if you can't work, if you're not fit for work because of a personal illness, and that's the minimum standard, and that's 10 days a year.
And so if you use up your 10 days or you've used it up before an example where you might have to go into quarantine, what are your options?
Well, the thing is, if you go into quarantine, the question is, are you actually unfit to work? So if you're not sick, you couldn't access personal leave anyway. Personal leave is only if you're unfit to work. And there's a real argument there as to, well, if I'm not actually sick, am I unfit to work? I'm being directed into quarantine, perhaps, and maybe my employer is telling me to stay at home. But in those circumstances, I'm not actually sick. I'm ready, willing and able to work. In the sense I haven't contracted an illness, I'm not suffering symptoms. So perhaps I can't access sick leave at all.
So what should happen to you? Do you just have to stay home on leave without pay?
No, I would say that if your employer says to you, well, I don't want you to come into work, even though you're not actually sick, then it's effectively a suspension from work. And I would say, well, then you have to continue paying me or try and work out some other arrangement, perhaps working from home. Because at the moment, I'm really willing and able to work, but you're directing me to stay at home. It's a different proposition if I, and this is what makes it so perverse in a sense, if I say, okay, I'm going to do the right thing and I'm going to self-isolate, then the employer's not actually obliged to pay me personally, because the employer could say, well, you're not sick, you're not actually unfit for work. Great that you've chosen to self-quarantine, but we're not actually obliged under the law to pay you. And so I think what this virus outbreak is showing is the law isn't quite ready for this situation or hasn't adapted to this situation, hence the calls for a special additional leave by the ACTU and others.
Let's just clarify too. I mean, casual workers aren't generally entitled to sick leave. So even if they were in a position where they could access their sick leave, if they had it, what would happen to them?
Yeah, that's right. Casual workers aren't entitled to sick leave. So they're in a really difficult position, because if they're sick and they can't attend work, then they don't get sick leave. If they're not offered shifts, then they may not have any recourse. That being said, if you're a casual with regular and systemic shifts for over 12 months and you've stopped getting offered shifts, you can access unfair dismissal laws. But casuals are in precarious work. That's the very nature of their existence. And that's why they're so much more vulnerable in these situations.
We've had a text from Sam too. How about pay for workers who are ordered by the boss to stay home because another worker had contact with a virus carrier? So there's, kind of 2 degrees of not being sick.
Yeah, that's right. But that's the same as what I described earlier. So the worker who's been ordered to go home isn't actually unwell and is being told to go home. And I accept that, of course, employers are entitled to take reasonable precautions. But my point here is that if I'm not unwell, why am I being forced to exhaust my sick leave in circumstances where an employer is taking particular precautions? I suppose the sleeper argument in all of this is something the employer might say, or someone might say, well, you've got to be ready, willing and able to work. And are you able to work if you cause a, if you're a potential risk to the safety of yourself and others? And this is where it gets a little bit grey and a little bit difficult. How do you actually assess that risk? Let's just say I take care of my son because he's had the flu. And then my employer, and then I want to come back to work. I've used my carer's leave. I want to come back to work. And my employer says to me, actually, no, I think you're a risk to everyone else because your son had a pretty serious flu and you've been with him for a couple of days. No, I want you to stay at home. Is that fair? Most people would say no. Should I be forced to take personal leave for that situation? I think most people would say no. What you've got here is actually something similar. It's just on such a bigger scale that some of the basic principles and employment protections are being threatened and can get chucked out of the window in a panicked response.
And you mentioned unfair dismissal before, Sivaraman. Have you had any inquiries about unfair dismissal yet?
I haven't had unfair dismissal inquiries yet, but I certainly have had inquiries by people who've been told to stay home. I think the best example I can give you was someone who had actually been overseas to Sri Lanka and had come back. And before he was to go back to work, his employer contacted him and said, look, our management's had a meeting and we've just decided that we think you should stay at home for 2 weeks and just take more annual leave because you went to Sri Lanka and came back. And he contacted me and I said, no way. Firstly, Sri Lanka wasn't identified as one of the countries that had a high risk. Secondly, you can't be directed to take annual leave as a general rule. So I don't think that's lawful. In the end, that resolved because they agreed that he could work from home. So he just continued to work and to get paid. But you can see how easily in a panic response, and that clearly was a panic response because that was a few weeks ago.
And you can also see how easily it would be hard to apply working from home to a whole swath of workers. I want to go to Andrew Stewart from the Adelaide Law School as well on this. Andrew, you heard Geary say that there's been no precedent for the situation we're in at the moment. Lots of issues are arising from the murky legal situation. And the Prime Minister this week called on business leaders to do their patriotic duty and look after their workers. What's your view on that? Should it be up to business or government to decide how best to support workers?
Well, I think Geary is absolutely right in pointing to the slightly perverse consequences of trying to apply our laws to a situation for which it was never designed. I mean, it's very odd that someone who's sent home might not be entitled to take sick leave. Someone who's forced to go home because their kid's school or childcare centre is closed down probably is entitled to take personal leave. But look, what I think this situation is going to demand is a lot of common sense and a lot of give and take to try and get through this situation with employers still able to run their businesses, but workers not needlessly having to lose pay. And that may often mean that there will be arrangements made about taking leave, sometimes granting sick leave that's not actually available, sometimes agreeing to use up some annual leave as the best way to get through the situation. The problem, though, about suggesting that businesses should simply be able to do this because they're patriotic is more than a little silly. Businesses don't tend to be patriotic. They act in the best interest of their shareholders. Many large businesses will form the view that they can both afford to and need to make a lot of concessions to their workers. We've already seen a lot of businesses around the world announcing that they'll provide leave which would otherwise be available or help maintain pay even though there's not enough work to be done. But there are many, many small businesses in particular that can't afford to do that. So the argument about let's just all be patriotic, I think, really shouldn't obscure the need for the government to think about stepping in and doing something, maybe just for this situation, but maybe for future situations where you have this kind of mass public health problem that can really provide a more secure foundation for managing this than our current laws provide.
But do you think the government might be worried that they would set a precedent for future events? I mean, we've had SARS, we've had H1N1, we've had MERS. It seems unlikely that we're going to not have future viruses that might cause this level of disruption.
But why is there a problem setting a precedent to deal with a situation that might recur? The point here is that this isn't a case of something that any one person or one business or one worker in the community should be managing. There is a massive problem for our entire economy and society that's posed by these kind of illnesses. They threaten to not just the health of people, obviously, not just the fact that many people will die as a result of this virus, but they threaten massive economic dislocation. It's in the interests of all of us, particularly at a time when the economy is in such a shabby position anyway. It's really in the interest of everyone to put measures in place that provide a bit of confidence and have people in the community, businesses, workers, everyone in the community feel that the government is helping them get through. So I would seriously be arguing for a package that is suited to this particular situation, but then looking at having something in place that works for future outbreaks of this kind.
So looking at the stimulus package that's being announced today, so cash payments to businesses of $2,000 to $25,000, greater tax relief, subsidies for apprentice wages, what are your thoughts on that model?
I think the problem there is that it doesn't do enough to get straight to households. It doesn't deal with the very real problem of having a very large number of workers in our community who, as Giri says, are in insecure jobs and really faced with the problem of, well, I need to keep earning wages. We're creating a massive incentive. As long as we leave a large group of workers without any entitlements to protect their income, we're creating a massive incentive for those workers to ignore any sniffles they got and say, well, it's just a cold or it's just allergies. Let me go to work anyway because I'm terrified of losing a day's pay or a week's pay. That's not a healthy way and not a sensible way to deal with an outbreak as serious as this. But then from the economic stimulus point of view, I've also seen a lot of commentary by economists that say that the by far the most effective way to stimulate the economy is to get money into the hands of the people who need it most and are likely to spend it. If you give wage subsidies to low-paid workers, the one thing you can guarantee is they will not save it. They will go and spend it. And that provides the economic boost. So there's far more bang to the buck in that kind of direct support to workers. It's not to say that there isn't a role for business support. There absolutely has to be some support for business in this kind of situation. But I've seen a lot of commentary from people whose opinions I trust, which suggest that direct household support would work much more effectively.
And we are seeing $500 amounts go to people on various forms of government benefits. Text has just popped in saying, I was made redundant last year, and since I've been an Uber driver, I can only make money if I drive. So if I'm unwell, too bad, I have to drive to earn money. But interestingly, Giri, Uber is saying it will give Uber and Uber Eats drivers up to 14 days compensation if they're diagnosed or if they're asked to self-quarantine by a public health authority. What do you think of that move?
It's very interesting. It's a concession, I think, by Uber to the unfairness of the relationship and the power that it has. The big issue for Uber drivers and all of the people that are in the gig economy is, are they employees? If you're not an employee, you don't pass go, you don't qualify for carer's leave. And of course, that's been challenged a couple of times now. Fedora drivers who were dismissed, riders who were dismissed, challenging and saying we can launch unfair dismissal cases. The tax office saying, actually, I think there's an employment relationship and therefore you should remit tax. But really, the starting point for Uber, Deliveroo and all the other gig economy operators is we don't have an employment relationship. This is just people contracting with us. They're independent contractors. Therefore, they're not entitled to personal leave. So I think it's a really interesting move by Uber and just reflective of the public sentiment of what actually is fair.
You were talking before about the legal intricacies that this situation was throwing up. What happens if you're casual and you just notice you're getting fewer shifts? Shifts are starting to dry up after you were quarantined. Do you have legal options there?
I would argue that potentially you would. As I said, as a casual, you can access unfair dismissal laws if you've had regular and systemic shifts for 12 months. And if the shifts dry up, it's always difficult to pinpoint that exact point where you say, okay, this is the point I've been dismissed. But even if it's a bit artificial, I still think you could, because you might be able to point to having many more shifts before and so few now, which is even a demotion can be a termination of employment, can be a dismissal. So I think you could still make an argument there.
There's also the question of medical certificates, because employers will quite reasonably want to see one if they're going to grant someone sick leave or any other kind of leave for staying at home. But the health system's already saying it's overwhelmed by people wanting certificates and other kinds of help. Can employers compel employees to get a certificate, or is there any wiggle room there?
Yes, they can compel you to get a certificate, but as an alternative, you could, in circumstances where it's you can't get a certificate, you could provide a statutory declaration about what's occurred. But I mean, that's obviously difficult, because you'll have to go do draft it, you'll have to go find a JP to affirm it. So there is that alternative as well.
Now, Andrew Stewart, we've got a higher proportion of casual workers compared to lots of other countries around the world. What would be a solution, do you think, to this precarious nature of work? Can you just make all the casuals permanent and that would fix this situation that we're seeing here?
Well, there's actually an argument that a lot of the people who are working as casuals in Australia at the moment, more than a million Australians are in what are effectively long-term casual jobs. There is actually an argument, and this is something that's being fought out in the courts at the moment, that some of those casuals are really permanent workers. So it is possible that we might even see some cases coming out of the COVID-19 episodes where some workers say, well, you know what, I've been working for you for 3 years, I've had a stable job, yes, you've been treating me as a casual, I'm really not a casual at all, and therefore you should be paying me sick leave. I'll be very surprised if we don't see some sorts of arguments about that. And as I say, there are already cases in the courts about that. But I do think that this episode, the fact that it's highlighted that so many workers do not have, apparently at least, access to sick leave, whether it's because they're casual or it's because they're working in the gig economy and business that's using their services is insisting they're contractors rather than employees. I do think this focuses on the need to take a closer look at whether all of those relationships need to be as legally insecure as they currently appear to be. This is an issue which a lot of people have been talking about, myself included, for a long, long time. There may be some better ways of ensuring that people can still have flexibility in their jobs. And look, a lot of people who work as casual want to be casual. They like the flexibility. They like the higher loading they're getting, if they're being paid correctly. And they don't mind giving up some leave entitlements. But this kind of episode suggests that there are times when there really does need to be access to some kind of safety net. So,
well, and Christian Porter made the point that the loading is meant to be in lieu of sick leave. What's your thoughts about that, that perhaps people should have been socking away that money for a rainy day?
Well, of course, he's technically correct to say that the 25% casual loading you get is meant to be instead of annual leave, sick leave and so on. I'd love for the Attorney General to find the casual worker who's carefully squirreled their 25% loading away in an interest-bearing account, just waiting for the day when they have to take leave. I mean, that's just not practical. There are many, many casuals who, particularly a lot of university students, for example, who come from well-off backgrounds, can perfectly afford to miss out on a few shifts. But there are also a huge number of low-paid casuals who rely on that income to be able to feed themselves or their families. And the idea that they've been putting aside money out of their, you know, pretty meagre wage is frankly nonsense. So I do think this is an issue where, in the short term, to deal with this particular, it does seem to be a looming crisis that we're facing, do think there's a need to look at ways of supporting workers and giving them incentives to obey instructions to stay at home or obey advice to stay at home. But in the longer term, it also focuses attention on the need to rethink a lot of these insecure arrangements.
Yes, it raises questions of what the greater good will look like in the future. Thank you both so much for joining us on Life Matters today. Giri Sivaraman and Andrew Stewart, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Hilary.
Giri Sivaraman is an employment lawyer with Maurice Blackburn, and Andrew Stewart's a professor at the Adelaide Law School. And the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, in an interview earlier today, when asked about support for Australia's 3.3 million casual workers, said that the welfare system offered payments which could be, quote, targeted to those sort of things, and that he will have more to say about that today.